Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight on the Best of Movie Geeks United, we hear from two legends. One is a master filmmaker whose command of the visual language has entranced audiences for over four decades. The other is a legend in the world of TV journalism who steps behind the feature film camera for the first time in his long, illustrious career. Both of them put it all on the line as they grapple with cinematic treatments illustrating the unbearable burdens of war. Brian De Palma and Phil Donahue coming up next on the Best of Movie Geeks United.
The other criticism is that releasing the film while we're still embroiled in the conflict can somehow prove deadly to our troops.
Ridiculous. I mean, we're doing so much damage over there. Do you think this film is going to have any effect in relationship to cluster bombs? I doubt it.
Now we learn the generals were in the tank. Imagine, they're getting briefed by Rumsfeld and running over to Fox. Can't wait to end MSNBC and everybody else's CNN. I mean, this president took this nation by the ear and led us right into the sword. This is awful.
United on the air. This is the Best of special series where we replay some of the highlights of the past 15 months, the 15-month history of our show. And we're pleased to do it tonight. Tonight, a very special double feature, if I may say so myself, Jerry.
It's a big double feature. I mean, where else, as you said, where else you get Phil Donahue and Brian fucking De Palma on the same show?
That's right. That's a great, that is actually his middle name. I don't know if people realize that. Brian De Palma. It's interesting. I wanted to share some insights with you guys, you listeners out there, about some of these interviews, because a lot of you guys have caught up with us at different points in our show's history, and maybe you haven't gone back through the archives. But Brian De Palma, I would say that, Jerry, in a large part, I mean, the friendship that you and I share is somewhat based upon our kinship over De Palma films.
I think so. Yeah, especially the early films. Yeah, definitely. Definitely the 70s, early 80s era. I absolutely, that's a very true point.
Because you obviously have always been crazy about De Palma. I have always been crazy about De Palma, and we thought we were the only two people on the planet outside of Chris that were crazy about De Palma.
And then some of the other people we discovered who were crazy about De Palma. Well, we're not going to go there.
There are tons because many people have told us that they got hooked on our show because in the first 3 months of our show we did a Brian De Palma tribute. And many people came to us and said, that's when I started listening.
That was one of our highest-rated shows at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And then a couple of months later, he had his movie redacted. And, I didn't have any contact information for De Palma. I didn't know how to get in touch with him. But I did find the PR company behind Redacted, and I sent I bombarded them with interview requests.
Right.
I had no idea if De Palma knew anything about us, even though we'd already done the tribute show. But I bombarded them with interview requests. They said no. And then I sent another one to a second PR person in that company, somebody that would actually take the request to him, I guess. And then they said, okay, he'll do this night with you guys. So we did the interview with him. We were so excited, thrilled, nervous, uncertain.
There's a lot of that because you don't know how it's going to go. I mean, you never know how it's going to go, what kind of mood these people are going to be in.
This is the most combative, and plus given the film that he was promoting, and he was, it's like he was in combat as he was promoting it because everyone was down his neck about it.
Right.
Yeah, and so... but he was lovely, and then we brought on another guest who had the great pleasure of interviewing De Palma in previous film festivals throughout the past few months, and he told us De Palma's been talking about you guys. You know, he actually heard your tribute show, and he's been asking me about it since I was a guest on the tribute show,
mm-hmm.
and he knows all about it. So De Palma knew us.
Yeah,
love us.
Knew us and wanted to know where William Catt was. What was he doing that was more important than our show?
William Catt did not show up on the tribute show, and he was fully aware of that. And so that really warmed our hearts. And if I have a regret about the interview, you know, it is our major coup, I think, in getting De Palma,
mm-hmm.
and it really established, you know, a bunch of confidence for us as hosts of the show. I'm thrilled as punch that he did the show. I'm not very secure in my interview with him because I feel like this was one of the most important films of his career. I wanted to focus mainly on this film. But being a De Palma fan, just like you, Jerry, I mean, I had three times more questions.
Yeah,
about
we had tons
else.
Of questions.
And so I couldn't fit that in. I felt like, you know, but if anyone's going to come back to us, any of these biggies, I think that De Palma would be very receptive to doing that.
Yeah,
so
for
we
this
can...
Boston Strangler film, maybe he'll come back. You know?
Yeah, and then we can bombard him with all those geeky questions.
Yeah, I think he'd appreciate that. What I've noticed, though, and I think we do have to emphasize, is since he's never gotten the critical love, he does get it from the fans, he understands that, and he's more than willing to talk to the fans.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
He really will give a lot of his time to the internet sites and everything very freely. I noticed over the years because
those are some of the people out there that give him a fair shake. You know?
Yeah, I mean, some people just write him off immediately, and you know, others, you know, they understand. They like the older work. They understand that, and that's why they're willing to give him the benefit of the doubt whenever he has a movie come out. They realize there's potential in each film. Even if it doesn't turn out the way they think, they realize that you're dealing with, you know, not everyone can hit it out of the gate, you know?
Right, right.
So you got to give him the benefit of the doubt. Really, you have to do that with everyone, I think.
Up to that point, we had done maybe the Blair Witch Project reunion, where we reunited the directors with one of the stars of the Blair Witch Project,
mm-hmm.
and that was a high profile show. But De Palma was our first. I told you last night, it's like we've almost gotten to a stage where we're surpassing the A-listers. Because the A-listers change every year.
Right.
But we've gone straight to the legends for some reason. And I've been trying to get the A-listers. But I think it's on De Palma's back. I think people see that we've interviewed De Palma, and that begets Paul Schrader. And Paul
mm-hmm.
Schrader, you know, who knows from there. And Phil Donahue. And, you know, they know that we're of substance, that we're able to interview these people, even
right.
though we're still blabbering geeks.
We're not
so,
even really blabbering geeks. We're really
not. I feel like that inside. I always
right.
do.
Inside, maybe, but I don't think we come across that way on the outside.
No.
And if we don't, we got to change that. Maybe we do have to. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, I always feel like that on the inside. I don't ever want to not feel like that. I don't want to be jaded and not, you know,
right,
because
exactly.
I genuinely care
well,
about
I didn't,
these people.
Didn't mean it, jaded. I didn't mean that we'd be jaded. I just, yeah.
Yeah. So let's play this De Palma interview. This is from around redacted time, about probably 8 months ago now. Here it is. Brian De Palma interviewed on Movie Geeks United with one of my, you know, this was the intro to end all intros, because I'd written intros before, and I was like, man, there's a lot on the line with this intro. So here it goes.
I mentioned director tributes and archive shows. Our loyal listeners may recall a 2.5-hour tribute show we conducted back in July in honor of our first guest tonight. The cinematic icon has been dazzling audiences for much of the past 4 decades, having crafted breathtaking and timeless films like Carrie, Dress to Kill, Blowout, Scarface, Carlito's Way, The Untouchables, Mission Impossible, and the hauntingly powerful Casualties of War. He has set himself apart as a thoughtful social commentator and a wildly expressive visual storyteller. And like all great artists, his work never fails to challenge, provoke, and inspire. Now, he delivers the most controversial and feverishly debated film of his career. Redacted offers a fictionalized account of a real-life incident involving the rape and murder of a 14-year-old Iraqi girl at the hands of several American soldiers. The film is profoundly moving, confrontational, infuriating, and, in spite of the comments from naysayers, many of whom haven't even bothered to view the film, it is also deeply compassionate. It is a tremendous honor for the Movie Geeks to welcome to the show one of our greatest inspirations from the world of cinema, Mr. Brian De Palma. Mr. De Palma, hello.
Thank you for that illustrious introduction.
Well, we are so honored to have you with us tonight, and let me say, Chris and I viewed the film the other night, and it is a remarkable piece of work. And I want to get right to it. You know, you've you've been through a lot of, you've suffered a lot of criticism throughout your career, and even for your thrillers, and I think so unfairly so. But now Redacted is, obviously it's out there now, and it's in the press, and it's being criticized by a lot of people that haven't even seen it. Did you anticipate this kind of firestorm when you embarked on this project, or is it just all old hat for you at this point?
No, I thought I'd be getting into a lot of hot water because I'm presenting a view of the troops that nobody's ever seen before.
Yeah. Well, you've said that the newspaper and the television images that were presented to the American public during Vietnam sparked the uprising to stop that war, and Redacted is in a large part a response to the new media that don't put those images on display as they once did. When did you first notice this kind of sterilization in the media's approach, and how much of a factor do you believe the modern media has on the culture's perception and possible apathy towards the current war?
Well, with the embedded reporters, first there was the first Gulf War where the reporters never, left the press room, never got near what was going on. And then the second war, Afghanistan and Iraq, where you're getting reports from embedded reporters, and they just seemed a little whitewashed and more like propaganda rather than what exactly the reality was on the ground.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, if you wanted to get that, you just had to sort of go into the Internet, and soldiers would be blogging, and there would be pictures. And this is all the stuff I discovered when I was researching the material.
Yeah.
But the first question always with a director is, where are the pictures?
Uh-huh.
In Vietnam, we saw the pictures in Look and Life magazine and on CBS Evening News. There were no pictures.
Yeah.
And what's kind of astounding to me is that administration officials can just sort of lie, and it doesn't seem to bother anybody.
Mm.
That's very true.
They can run clips of them saying the opposite things right next to each other, and nobody seems to be disturbed by that.
It does seem to be one lie after another, and I absolutely don't know when the American outrage is going to start.
It's just amazing to me. Even like tonight on the news, they're reporting, some whistleblower, AT&T, discovers that they've been bugging everybody's phone, and it just wasn't international calls; it was everything,
mm-hmm.
everything being gone into a sort of a black room and split off to some government agency. And, of course, all they used to say is, no, we're only monitoring calls from abroad to, Middle East countries.
Yeah.
And
it's like a blatant, it just outrage doesn't seem to matter anymore.
Yeah.
That's very true.
Now, speaking of filmmaking, have you been disappointed by the filmmaking community's creative reaction to this war thus far?
Well, that's bothered me for quite a while. I mean, I had a friend that was sort of, doing an article about, what's going on in, independent filmmaking. And I said, well, why don't you go to the selection committee at Sundance and see if anybody's making any political films? And she went and found out there were, none, like 5-6 years ago. And I'm thinking, God, this is kind of amazing.
Yeah. And
nobody's
and
disturbed about what's going on in the political, scene in our country. They're just making films about, coming of age and, does Mary love me and, am I a homosexual? It's like one after another, and you're thinking, we're creating a huge mess in the Middle East, and nobody doesn't seem to bother, young filmmakers at all, which is the antithesis of what happened to me when I started to make movies.
That's just it, because I hate to get on my 70s soapbox, but the 70s were an amazing period for cinema, but there were a lot of films actually that were about something during that time, about what was going on in the world at that time, and we seem to be losing that today.
Well, the thing is that, we could be drafted. So Greetings is basically, how do we avoid the draft?
Yeah.
And that was, that was something you really worried about and figured out all kinds of ways to get out of the draft. And nobody I knew ever went into the Army. They always found a way to get out. And the people that did go were people that actually wanted to go, you know, like David Rabe or Oliver Stone. Mm. They wanted to go and, you know, experience, you know, men at war. But your people don't seem to rely on their, you know, basic instincts, you know, that basically say, what are we doing there? Mm. And you listen to all the, you know, intellectual mumbo jumbo that they feed you. You know, the domino theory, or the whole world's going communist, and, you know, and you go, well, these countries have been fighting each other for generations. Suddenly they're all going to band together and attack us. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't make any sense. And this, of course, is the same thing with weapons of mass destruction. I mean, I don't even know who came up with that. It wasn't around like, 5, 6, 7 years ago. Nobody even, you know, they came up with this term, and they keep on beating you to death with it to, you know, make you afraid. And this, you know, and I see all these techniques because, you know, I made a lot of flight films, so I'm aware of how you get people scared.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Do you think it's the fact that there is not a draft? Do you think it would take a draft to inspire an uprising and kind of a more widespread protest of this war?
Well, they hide everything. That's what's so amazing about it. You know, it's like the whole, you know, incredible debt we're getting into. I mean, you know, everybody's, you know, living on credit, so you don't really feel the, you know, the pain that you did like in the Second World War and you had to go, you know, buy war bonds. You know, you think, oh, well, this is something we could figure out down the line. But, you know, one day you're going to walk in and, you know, open up the cupboard and there's going to be nothing there. And,
sure.
And the government will say, oops. Sorry.
Yeah. Jerry, you actually...
Yeah, I have a question. Yeah. I first want to say it's like, you know, you're fighting a war and you're asking people not to sacrifice and you're having tax cuts. It doesn't make a lot of sense. But I do have a question for you, Mr. De Palma. What's striking to anyone with knowledge of your work is the amazing similarity between the real event depicted in Redacted to the one that you depict in Casualties of War. What made you decide that this was a story you wanted to tell here when you had already explored it before?
Well, I was struck, of course, by the fact that the incidences were so similar. It was like, you know, just like Vietnam is so much, you know, so similar to Iraq. And this type of atrocity happened more or less for the same reasons. And since I had no real firsthand knowledge or couldn't even use any information about the actual perpetrators in this case, I relied on the characters that were created in Casualties of War. But then I just had to find a different way to tell the story, and by researching it, I found all these unique, you know, digital modes on the internet.
Mm. Okay, I have just another thing. Do you think that I notice in both films? Do you think that the rape is a metaphor for the larger issue of imperialism?
No, absolutely. I mean, we're raping a country. I mean, absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, that's why Casualties of War seemed to me the quintessential story about Vietnam. We are raping a country. We are demolishing it. We are destroying it. Mm. You know, and...
It's a very powerful metaphor. You couldn't pick a better, a more violent metaphor.
Exactly. You know, not only did they, you know, did they rape her and kill her, then they set her on fire. I mean, it's essentially what we're doing to Iraq, you know, and that's what I also felt about Vietnam. I mean, you know, in order to save the village, we have to level the village.
Right.
So it's of course it's a great metaphor, and that's what struck me about Casualties of War, and I took a long time to get it made. These pictures are impossible to get made.
Mm. You discussed the visual structure of your film briefly. You're using a variety of media here, from video blogs to YouTube-style clips and surveillance cameras. In Vietnam, I suppose you could claim it was the television war. But do you think that Iraq is becoming the internet version of that? And was that what inspired you to structure the film in this manner?
Well, it's kind of a combination of things. I discovered the forms in the research. Otherwise, I went on the internet and, you know, you put in, you know, Iraq casualties or Iraq, U.S. soldiers rape, and you come up with all kinds of stuff, and then you come up with all kinds of people commenting on it, and then you come up with, you know, sites and army wives, you know, and montages of horrendous casualty pictures, and you see all these forms, you know, even the Wild Bill, the rant of the girl late in the film. I mean, that was one of the few things we actually bought. We actually got the rights to use the material that Wild Bill had put on his website.
Right.
That's his material. I just basically dramatized it a little bit, and the best person that read for it was this, you know, very dynamic girl. So, and I'm interested in this form because, you know, I'm kind of a little bored with kind of straightforward filmic, you know, storytelling. I've kind of seen it all before. I've kind of, you know, made a lot of films, you know, and these kind of forms are kind of exhausted and they're getting tired and retread, and television just sort of, you know, takes the lifeblood out of them. So this was quite an exciting thing for me because I found a whole different way to tell a story in something that seemed perfect for the material I was trying to convey to the audience.
Absolutely perfect, yeah. I want to touch upon a couple of points that I believe are gross misconceptions about the film, and of course they're being perpetrated by people who haven't even seen it. But let me put forth a couple of the main criticisms and get your response to them, if I may. One of the criticisms is that it paints all American soldiers as monsters.
Well, that's untrue, of course, and I very specifically, you know, point out, I mean, they say they're bad apples, and incidences like this are always motivated by one guy that's the wild card, and I spent a long time sort of delineating that. Anytime, you know, whether it's in Cold Blood or the Yablonsky murders, there's always the guy that pushes it too far.
Mm.
And these guys would never have done this by themselves. It's a sequence of events, and then suddenly there's this guy that's just a little tweaked, a little different than everybody else. And that was, of course, very much the story of Casualties of War, and very much the story in this case, because the guy, you know, when they say the bottom of the gumbo barrel, I mean, we're recruiting people that we normally would not recruit. I mean, that's another secret the Army doesn't want to tell us about. You know, we're dealing with people that are a little questionable to begin with.
Yeah.
And this particular guy had all kinds of psychological problems and was on his way of being, rejected by the Army before this incident. You know, and of course, the endless cover-up is, of course, what the Army always does in these instances until, you know, it's so humiliated and everybody's talking so much that they can't cover it up anymore, which is the story of My Lai and Haditha and, you know, all this stuff.
I think it's, anyone that actually views the film, I think it's very obvious that I believe your film is incredibly fair-minded and every viewpoint is represented within the film. I mean, there's an amazing sequence where they unknowingly shoot and kill a pregnant woman.
Yes, based on an actual incident.
Yes, and then the conversation that follows, you know, one of them is absolutely horrified and criticizing the shooter, and the shooter says, "It's my job. How am I to know?"
And the Sarge is the one that sort of shuts them all down. I mean, that's a real Sarge.
Oh,
I mean, that guy is a real sergeant.
Mike,
you know,
Figueroa,
he's
right?
In the Army.
Yeah.
Mike, he's, you know, in the Army. He's still in the Army. He's been to Afghanistan and Iraq. And that's that. I didn't write that. He just jumped up in the middle of it and did what a sergeant would do. You know, shut up. This is what happens. This is what you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
Now go to bed and stop arguing, basically.
Yeah, incredible sequence. The other criticism is that releasing this film, this is just a crazy crazy criticism here. Releasing the film while we're still embroiled in the conflict can somehow prove deadly to our troops.
Ridiculous. I mean, we're doing so much damage over there. Do you think this film is going to have any effect in relationship to cluster bombs? I doubt it.
Yeah. but you make no secret of the fact that the single most important objective in making this film for you was to inspire an end to the war.
Yeah, because we don't see any of this stuff. This is why everybody's getting so steamed up about this film. They're like horrified about how could soldiers be this way and how can you show this picture? Well, I lived through Vietnam. I saw all this stuff over and over again.
Yeah.
And it's just shows how well the Pentagon has kept all this stuff away from everybody that they're seemingly so shocked by it now.
But what do you believe is the capacity for the film to provoke a positive change, especially among what I would have to say is a very jaded populace?
Well, always the images. If you can get the images out there and people are disturbed enough about it, then they'll start asking some questions. And all they have to do is go on the Internet like I did, and they'll find all the answers.
Wow.
You know, this is a movie that, you know, you say, this really happened? Guys are really like this? Just get your Google search engine and take a look.
Right. You're absolutely right.
I wanted to touch upon a little bit, because you've said that your film itself has been redacted, the final montage showing the real-life pictures of slain Iraqis. And I read something interesting in Mark Cuban's blog, and I want you to tell me if this is the norm or not. Mark Cuban said in his response to a letter from Bill O'Reilly's show, I believe, he said, "I didn't read the script or know all that much about it before we greenlit it." Is that unusual for the main backer of a film? And was it
It had nothing to do with it. This is a program they have, you know. They give established filmmakers, you know, like $5 million. Do anything you want. Just do it on high definition.
Yeah.
Mark Cuban's not paying any attention to it. The only time he kind of woke up is, I guess, when some lawyer said, "Have you seen these pictures that are in the movie?" And all of a sudden they went, "Oh, my God, oh, we can't have anything to do with this."
So it was understood from the get-go that that montage would be included.
Absolutely. That montage, if you put, you know, Iraq casualties images into a search engine, you'll come up with a dozen montages like this. They're all over the Internet. This is where I got the idea. So I, you know, said to the producers, let's get the most, you know, emotional pictures we can get that nobody can seem to get published.
Mm.
You know, and we assembled a whole bunch of them. We, you know, HDNet lawyers wrote the releases for everybody, and, you know, everything was going along, and you know, we had insurance and everything. And then suddenly somebody, I'm sure up high in the company, said, "Oh, my God, have you seen these pictures?" And then, of course, just
and
like any big media company, they say, we can't show these. We can't be associated with this. And that's what happened.
Well, how ironic is it that they're upset? There's all this uproar, not about anything you've done, not about anything Brian De Palma's done, but about pictures that you had literally nothing to do with.
No, they were completely, they were assembled by my, basically by Eric Schwab, my associate. And he was over there well before I arrived. He talked to the Iraqi war photographers. He's the one that sort of collected all the images, and then I had an editor, picture editor at the New York Times. I said, "Send me all the pictures that you can't get published." And from that, we assembled the montage. And we wanted it to be, you know, very strong, because if we're involved over there and we're dropping bombs and we're killing people, I'd like to see it, because I'm paying for it.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's true.
How does this movie place for you in the scope of your career? Do you feel that this could be the most important film that you've ever done?
Oh, that's kind of hard to say. It's hard to have perspective like that. It's very exciting for me, because I think I found this whole different form. And then, as you know, in my movies, I'm constantly interested in, you know, the form and how to convey stuff through different forms. And, you know, I'm a bit of a, you know, a computer nut, and very into this kind of technology. So I'm interested in all these new forms, whether they be computer games or stuff going on the Internet. As I said, I'm getting kind of bored with the traditional filmic form, because, you know, I've done a lot of movies, and we have a great history of the use of this form. It's almost like, you know, writing opera. I mean, you know, the time may have passed. you know, for this form and their new forms, and I'm kind of excited about exploring them.
Mm. Would you say, in general, that this is something that interests me, watching your films, and I find especially in your later work, a more hopeful kind of thread. I'm thinking about Mission to Mars, and would you say that you're more of a hopeful or a cynic?
Well, I guess you would have to say that, you know, one becomes a cynic because one's hopes for the best are dashed so terribly.
Yeah.
But of course, one starts out sort of, you know, expecting the best and hoping for the best, and then when you're confronted with the reality on the ground, you go, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening. How can people be like this?
Yeah.
You know.
What amazes me about you, though, is it seems that you still have that same fire in the belly as you did when you first started out, and you.
Yeah, I get very upset by this. I mean, you know, it's you know, we're harming a lot of people. You know, we're going to have, you know, generations of soldiers scarred that are going to be wandering around VA hospitals. I lived up in Northern California near a VA hospital, and you see all those Vietnam vets wandering around with the 1,000-mile stare. I mean, my father was over in Vietnam, you know, doing surgeries. I mean, I've seen all this stuff, you know, and no, of course, nobody, you'll never see it on, you know, your mainstream media. Everybody, you know, that was, of course, the scandal of Walter Reed. I mean, they don't want to let you know what's happening. They just want to show you the guys with the, you know, incredibly new limbs and hopping around and how happy they all are.
Yeah.
But the scars of this war, all those 30, 40, 50,000 guys that came back with some terrible injury, this is going to go on for generations. And the trauma
years.
Of this war on this generation of soldiers is going to be a very sad thing to watch.
Yeah, and that's another thing, that another criticism, that it's too soon to make a film about our conflict over there. But when you watch this film, it's clearly a cry to stop the war, and in that case, you're just hoping that it's not too late.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've been, you know, we had an election where we tried to get them to stop this war. We don't have to seem to have much of an effect until we have the next election.
Yeah.
But who knows how long we're going to be there, and the wind down for Vietnam went on forever.
Okay, we have to close out this segment. Actually, we're movie geeks after all, so I have to ask you a few movie geek questions.
Okay. Go geeks.
I'm thinking about David Lynch. You know, he took the new digital technology with his last picture, and he says that he never wants to use film again. And I'm wondering how you took to the HD format, and if you're anxious to return to that for future.
Yeah, I am anxious to return to it. I don't want it to be a substitute for film. Like in any new media forms, you want it to find its own particular
identity.
Exactly,
yeah.
Identity. And I'm just starting to experiment with this. I have a lot more feelings about what's going on with this war. I could make another film like this. I like it because I can do it quickly. I'm sort of left completely alone. And I've got a lot, you know, I've always felt that, you know, once you've developed all these tools, you better have something to say. And that's what's so missing in so much of our contemporary cinema. Nobody has anything to say, even though they've spent years developing all kinds of techniques.
Technical, right. I agree with you completely. Now, I saw this on Jeff Baran's website with the De Palma à la Mode, and Jeff is fantastic. His website on you is fantastic as well. It was reported that you recently completed a script titled Shoot the Messenger. Can you give us any information on that?
As a matter of fact, except I'm not writing anymore because of the writer's strike, but yes, indeed, I did complete a script tentatively entitled Shoot the Messenger. Yeah, I'm very interested in dealing with the sort of George Orwell take on this war, and showing how the by things being re-edited and how myths are created and all the you know, the spinning that went on to sell this war, and I have, you know, have a lot of thoughts about, you know, using this digital form to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll be first in line for that film, just to let you know. I want to know a little bit about your next film, which I believe is a prequel of sorts to The Untouchables.
Well, again, we are still trying to cast this. We, you know, we've had this together with a bunch of different actors over the last couple of years, and things keep on falling in and out. I have nothing to report. We thought we had it together again. I don't know if it's going to pull itself together soon enough for me to shoot next year, because I have to shoot it in the wintertime because there's a Saturday night, rather a Valentine's Day massacre, and it's got to be done in the cold in February.
Mm.
So if I can't get it together in another month or so, I'm going to go off and do something else.
Well, I heard that you were trying to fill the spot of the young Al Capone, and you were looking for someone strong and sexy, and I just want to throw my hat in the ring.
Well, absolutely. Send your resume. The problem is I don't think we can raise any foreign money on your name. Maybe wrong.
Give it time.
I could be wrong.
Give it time. You might be able to.
Yes, could be.
I just have to ask you one more question before we let you go, because obviously you're an idol for all of us, a great inspiration, and another one of my cinematic idols, and every time I get a chance to ask about him, I seize the opportunity, is Al Pacino. And,
right.
And you've, of course, worked with him on Scarface and Carlito's Way. What can you tell me about the nature of that collaboration and what makes Pacino such a special talent?
Well, he's one of the unusual actors of his generation. He keeps going back to the stage. That is what actors should do. This, you know, movie acting is a form of acting. But, you know, to really sort of hone your skills, you really should go back on the stage where you have, you know, a certain amount of time to mold and create your character. And that's what makes him the great actor that he is. He's always going back to the stage. He's always, you know, testing himself and expanding what he can do. He's, you know, very curious. He likes to work with different, you know, people, you know, to get different input. And plus he's, you know, got a great sense of humor.
Yeah. I hear that he absolutely, the relationship with the director is of paramount importance to him. The open communication and the engagement between director and actor is something he really depends upon. Where you hear that other...
Well, you know, Al's, you know, worked with all kinds of directors and all kinds of different forms. He's kind of self-contained, you know, he's like one of those great actors that, you know, you sort of let them do what they do and, you know, try to get the cables out of their way and watch what they do and figure out a way to maximize what they're doing with the placement of the camera, which is what he really likes about me, is that, you know, it's like that very complicated shot in Carlito's Way up and down the escalators. I mean, you know,
yeah.
You know, only he and I working together could pull something that, like that off. Because normally people just, you know, shoot Al in, you know, medium close-ups. I mean, because he's so dynamic. But, you know, to me that's not really directing. Anybody can shoot over the shoulders and close-ups. And, you know, if you have a good script and a great actor, it'll all sort of work out somehow. But you've always got to figure out how to visually maximize the potential of what your actor's doing, and you have to watch him and see how he moves through a space and then figure out exactly where to put the camera to so that he can do what he does. And that was very true, like in the boardroom scene in Scarface, was to give him that space in order to work.
Yeah, yeah. Ah, well, Mr. De Palma, we can't tell you how much your movies mean to us, and we could talk to you for 3 or 4 days about your the rest of the films on your resume, but we know you need to go, but thank you so much for spending this time with us, and please come back to us whenever you'd like.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, geeks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now. Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
Bye-bye.
That is Brian De Palma. We just talked to Brian De Palma, guys.
Yeah, I know. I like how all of us didn't
like
a job.
No
What's
one
that?
Refers to us as geeks, and I actually kind of appreciate it.
Yeah, Brian De Palma called us geeks. That's great, Jerry. Doesn't that take you back? I mean, it doesn't feel like that long ago, but at the same time, it does. It kind of feels like that was such a hurdle that we passed, you know, such a milestone. So, are you there? Are you there, Jerry?
Yes, I'm here. I'm here.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that was great. What do you think about it? Listening to it again.
I like it. Like I said, I wish it wasn't straight. I wish it wasn't 85% redacted.
Yeah, that's my one regret.
Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, that's like I said, that's what he was out there promoting. That was his cause. You know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think if people, the more people who were criticizing, if they bothered to watch it, they would have calmed down.
Yeah.
They just really would have. I don't think, you know, I have strong feelings and I'm not crazy about it, but I don't think it was this thing, this anti-American film, far from
it.
And I just think people needed to watch it. And certain individuals in the media, especially, before just blasting it.
Right. And I've only seen it that one time, but I mean, I I had those strong feelings right after I saw it. And, I mean, so I still feel that way about it, that I believe in it very much. But De Palma, he's got some projects now. They've announced the next Iraq War-themed movie he's doing, and it deals more with media, the media's handling of the war. And then he's off to do a thriller based on the Boston Strangler case. So that's going to be interesting. That's right up his alley.
Do you realize that tonight, by doing this show, we're devoting more time to the Iraq War than all the networks and cable news networks for the whole week?
Yeah, and this is something that I want to make clear too. Sadly, you're right.
Yeah.
And we're a movie show, so, and I think you especially get it in this upcoming interview with Phil Donahue that we did, because we are a movie show. And politics are unavoidable when you're talking about these movies or talking to these guests. But I tried, at least with Donahue, to have him talk politics and for me to try to stay clear of it and focus as much as I could on the filmmaking.
Right.
And that process. Because I'm not comfortable, getting on a pulpit and talking politics. When we tickle it here and there in terms of the filmmaking, that's fine. I mean, politics are part of film just as anything else.
Well, it was unavoidable with the Phil Donahue one because we had several individuals in the chat room who wanted to call in and go after him for things that had nothing to do with the movie and nothing
to do with the
Iraq War.
Right.
It was insane.
And this goes to show you something, too. I mean, I stay up all hours of the night. I'm combing the internet for guest ideas and stuff. I see that Phil Donahue has a movie out. I'm thinking, Phil Donahue directed a movie? I look it up. He directed with a co-director who he brought on as well.
Mm-hmm. She was great. Ellen Spiro?
Ellen Spiro. Yeah, Spiro. First time behind the camera, something he feels very passionate about. This is what interests me. You've spent 35, however many years in media. You're a TV icon. All of a sudden you get behind the camera. What's that experience like?
Right.
That's what really fascinated me about it, and his belief in the medium of film to provoke change or discussion. And that's what we talked about somewhat in the interview. You know, I managed to get him, I sent off the interview request for him, say like 7 o'clock on a Sunday. By 8 o'clock, I had him booked.
Right.
It was really easy because he's very anxious to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And, the nerve wracking thing is that this has happened to me a couple of times on the show. I have to call them to give them reminders to call into the show.
That's right, so
they give me Phil Donahue's cell phone number. It's 15 minutes before the show. I'm shaking dialing those numbers on my cell phone. And, you know, he answers it, and it's Phil Donahue. I said, Mr. Donahue, this is Jamie with Movie Geeks United. Just going to remind you, sir, about your interview in 15 minutes. And, of course, my voice goes up 3 octaves when I say
Right. But it has to. I mean, it really does. When you're doing a show, especially even more so than the De Palma one, because you can focus on film, but with the Phil Donahue one, it is going to get very political. And I have to warn you, if we have John Cusack on, it's going to be incredibly political, because I don't think he's, while he, the movie is more of a satire, he wants to talk about these ads he's done for Move On.
Right.
And he really wants to...
Well, he wants to talk about the subject of his movie, too, which is
all
political.
Yeah, but it's all political. I mean, that's going to be, it's going to be unavoidable to really... And more power to him, because it's about, he's like one of the first actors I've noticed that's really... within, because the choice of his last two roles, Grace is Gone and War Incorporated, very strong, actually, especially on Grace is Gone, one of the better Iraq war films, is a very, very political individual. So I'd be very interested if we ever got him on.
For me, and we've gotten a maybe from him, so I'm following up.
Yeah.
For me, it's like we aren't a political show, but we're a show about filmmakers and what people make films about. And so for me, it's about letting the guest air out his opinions.
Yeah.
And not necessarily have it be, you know, a four-part rally.
No,
you know, rah, 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 we're all behind you.
It shouldn't be
and
like
that's
that.
That's why I didn't do that a little bit with De Palma. I think I did it more successfully with Donahue. Well, I was just so, enamored
with
De Palma.
It's easier to do with, because we know De Palma for other things, though, too. So we're not going to, I don't see, if he ever did Bill O'Reilly, I don't see Bill O'Reilly asking him about Obsession or Body Double, because quite frankly, I don't think Bill's ever seen them or knows who they are. But
Wouldn't that be something to see them go head to head? That would.
I would love to see Brian jump over his side.
Wow. Wow. Okay. Welcome to everyone out there in the chat room. That's a little insight into our De Palma interview and our Donahue interview that we're about to replay. I welcome everyone to the chat room, and I thank you so much for joining us tonight for this Best of Movie Geeks United, the first edition. We're going to do these from time to time. This Sunday, we have the director of The Whackness, Jonathan Levine, who this movie was a big hit at Sundance, and the stars are out there promoting it, Sir Ben Kingsley, who gave us a no today for an interview, and Famke Janssen are out there promoting it. Very, very touching, hip film that premiered at Sundance this past year to great acclaim. And then we also are welcoming another stellar filmmaker, and his film is called Dear Zachary. And I saw that at the Sarasota Film Festival earlier this year. And it's been three months ago that I saw it, and it's pretty much. I can't think of a movie that's marked me deeper in my life.
Yeah, I remember you called me after you saw that.
I was completely shaken. And anyone that sees this movie, it is one of the most haunting, moving experiences you'll ever have. It's a documentary, and not everything, every point about the film can be revealed in the course of an interview or any review that you read of it, but go see it. It demands to be seen. We'll be talking about that with the filmmaker on Sunday. It's called Dear Zachary, and The Whackness on Sunday as well.
Right.
So it'll be a good Sunday show. So let's go on with Phil Donahue. You have any particular thoughts about how this interview went off? Were you happy with it?
I was happy with it. I really was, because he got to – because I think when we were both – he was on Bill Maher. And he said very little. I don't think there was actually opportunity for him to speak, considering...
You and I talked about that, didn't we?
Yeah.
Because we felt bad because he didn't get to speak. And I said, man, I'll let him speak on my show.
Yeah, exactly.
And there it was. And the people in the chat were talking about how obsessed I am. Yes, that's true. No, I don't sleep. And yes, I do have an actual day job, believe it or not. We all do.
Yeah, we all do. We're all obsessed, but we all have day jobs,
I'm a crime fighter by day.
He's a crime fighter.
No, that's not what I do at all. Okay, here's
you were a crime. Wait a minute. Okay, never mind.
I'll clear that up later. Here's Phil Donahue, and then we'll catch you on the tail end of this. Tonight, we are honored to welcome a legendary and beloved personality to our program. Throughout the 26-year run of his hit show, Donahue, which set the benchmark for all daytime TV talk shows that followed, tens of millions of viewers were captivated by his insatiable curiosity, probing analysis, and deep compassion. As it turns out, these same qualities define him as a filmmaker as well. Phil Donahue co-directs and co-produces the new documentary, Body of War, which tells the devastating but ultimately inspiring story of Thomas Young, a 25-year-old patriot who was shot and rendered a paraplegic 5 days into his tour in Iraq. The film follows Thomas as he finds the strength to live within his compromised body and the voice to speak in opposition of the war. Mr. Donahue's collaborator on this project is Ellen Spiro, a tremendously gifted artist who has built a distinguished career by pushing the limits of the documentary art form. Her resume of breathtaking works include multi-award-winning films like Greetings from Out Here, Rome Sweet Home, and Troop 1500. Body of War, which is currently running in limited theatrical engagements and film festivals across the country, recently won the Best Documentary Prize from the National Board of Review. It is a tremendous pleasure to welcome these two great, talented, and passionate artists to Movie Geeks United, Mr. Phil Donahue and Miss Ellen Spiro. Mr. Donahue and Miss Spiro, are you with us?
We are.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being with us tonight. It's a great honor to speak to you both. Now, I saw Body of War the other night, and it absolutely stunned me. It moved me to the core. And what I'm interested in is, Ellen, especially for you to come from the documentary field, you know, people talk about Hollywood's creative treatment of the war, and you know, that's one thing. But I find that the documentary filmmakers are really the ones that are on the front line of this conflict, and they're really producing some great work about this war. Don't you agree?
I do agree. I think there's been a big black hole left by the media, and documentary filmmakers came in to fill it, and then the media started talking about how badly documentaries about Iraq were doing at the box office, and people stopped going.
Well, in terms of why you chose, because Mr. Donahue, I realize that I think I read a quote from you that said that you didn't want to just make another anti-war documentary. So I'm wondering what idea first sparked the notion that you wanted to produce a film, and how do you see that this one differs from those that are already out there?
Well, we do think we're different. When I first met this young man at Walter Reed Army Medical Center, and learned about the gravity of his injury. He was very medicated at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I met him a long time before he met me. And his mother told me about the nature of this injury. Thomas is a T4. What that means is his spine is severed between your shoulder blades. If you put your arm up above your shoulder and drop your hand down your back as far as you can go, that's where the bullet severed Thomas's spine.
Yeah.
Thomas is paralyzed from the nipples down. Thomas can't walk. And I, you know, 24 years old, he's lying there. He's very thin, his cheekbones. He's totally white. And I just felt that the people should see this. I believe this has been a very sanitized war, and that it may account for the reason that only 18% of us now think that the Iraq war is the most important thing. Really, it's just a shame. I mean, these young people are coming home either dead, and you can't take a picture of their coffins because the president said you couldn't, and they all said okay, you know. And if you're going to send somebody, a nation to war, I think you have a responsibility to show the people the pain that many people are suffering because they answered the president's call. Thousands of people are going through what you see in our film, Body of War.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, there's 30,000 injured so far. And, you know, you multiply the people affected in your film by 30,000, and it's catastrophic. I mean, it's unimaginable.
Right. And the injuries in this war are especially hideous, worse than, you know, people are. We have blind people. Imagine, 20-something blind. The closer you get to Thomas, the more you realize what a huge, huge sacrifice he has made. He's 28 years old, and he can't walk. And by the way, he went to war for a president who won't approve stem cell research.
Yeah, really.
Yeah. And it's fitting to note, too, how he received his injury, where he received his injury, that bullet. It was an unarmored vehicle, wasn't it?
Yes. He was in the back of a truck with no top, Main Street, Sodder City, 25 guys jammed in there in the back. And they were, really, they gave fish in a barrel a new meaning.
Yeah.
I mean, they were just, and the bullet came down through his shoulder and somehow went through his body and severed his spine without hitting a major artery. Obviously, he wouldn't have survived. And
well,
here we are.
I'm interested in this because I definitely want to talk about Thomas. He's an extraordinary man. But your mentioning of the media and the media's reports on this war. We spoke to Brian De Palma months ago before the release of his film, and his whole point was the same, that during the Vietnam era, we were flooded with photos that came in our living rooms of the carnage and the devastation. What happened between then and now? Why the sanitation?
Well, you know, I don't. My guess is that efforts to sanitize the war were underway in Vietnam too, but they weren't as sophisticated as you have it today. Also, you know, I'm not sure we had as compliant a press during Vietnam as we have now.
Right.
You know, Halberstam and all that good reporting came reasonably early in the Vietnam War.
It did.
We haven't had much of that. Now we learn the generals were in the tank. Imagine, they're getting briefed by Rumsfeld and running over to Fox, can't wait to end MSNBC and everybody else's CNN. I mean, this president took this nation by the ear and led us right into the sword. This is awful.
Excuse me, Mr. Donahue, but didn't in 2003, wouldn't you have thought that listening to the generals on MSNBC and CNN, that they were in the Pentagon's grip? I mean, it sounded that way, didn't it?
Sure. That's why 77 senators voted to approve the Iraq War resolution. But what was, and only 133 members of the House, what was happening is we had an administration that couldn't wait to bomb Saddam. Couldn't wait. And they didn't care whether the United Nations had finished its inspection.
Right. It was a rush.
They wanted a merry little war, and they thought they had one. The aircraft carrier stunt gives them away.
Mm-hmm.
Ellen, how did you come on board the project?
One day, I was sitting at home, and the phone rang, and it was Phil Donahue on the other end, which, as you can imagine, pretty surreal.
Right.
It is right now.
Yeah. It's still surreal. Yeah. Yeah, so he told me this idea he had, and my immediate thought was that I wanted to meet Thomas because Phil was so passionate about Thomas and his story, and he couldn't stop thinking about Thomas since the day he met Thomas at Walter Reed Army Hospital. And so I said, well, you know, if it's a character-based documentary, we got to meet the character. So we met in Kansas City, and Thomas was not the Thomas that you see towards the end of our film. He could barely form a sentence. He was all drugged up, which is how the VA treated most of his injuries, was to prescribe lots of medications, including morphine. But he did manage to crack me up. And one of the things he said that day was, you know, I was asking him just about his experiences, and he said soldiers voting for President Bush are like chickens voting for Colonel Sanders.
And, I have a question,
you know,
for the chat room.
He never let up. Whenever things get too serious, Thomas makes sure that everybody gets to laugh.
Absolutely, yeah. He's remarkable. Jerry, you had a question from the chat room.
Yeah, because we had gotten onto the topic of Thomas. What is Thomas's view on his injury and his view of the war now? I don't, you know, that was one question I got regarding Thomas.
Yes.
I think he is adapting to his injury, which has been, I can't even imagine how challenging that is, to suddenly at you know, in your mid-20s, lose everything from your chest down and have to adapt. And our film shows that process, in addition to his consciousness evolving and him becoming this new person. You know, he came as close to death as a person can come, and he kind of comes back to life through our film, and even more so now, because he's really doing some interesting things now, including having executive produced an album with Eddie Vedder with 30 artists on it. And he's writing for Billboard magazine, traveling around with rock stars.
He's writing a book on his experiences too, isn't he?
Yeah. I think that's going to come from a collection of the blog essays that he's doing for Billboard, in addition to new material.
So what was his, when you approached him and said, expressed interest in making a film about his struggles, what were his directions? What did he want from this film?
Well, Thomas, at certain points, he started telling me what to do, which, you know, kind of rubbed me the wrong way at first. And then I thought, wait a minute. You know, he is the director of his own life.
Right.
And he has a part in the creative process. So he started coming up with ideas, and we would play around with them, and several of them are in the film.
So I'm wondering how the co-directing works. How were the – were you –
So are we. We're wondering how this works.
Were you shooting most of the time, Ellen, and Mr. Donahue? Were you seeing the footage and editing it, or how did that divvy up?
That's what happened, and I was impressed immediately. I mean, it was really the material that she brought back was just. She has such personal, emotional quality to her work, and. There were a lot she brought back. I mean, I just couldn't keep it in. I couldn't talk and I couldn't see after a lot of this. And we're out there being honest, you know, this film will make you cry. But it'll also make you laugh. And it'll inspire you. You'll see a family coming up from as big a hit. I mean, this is their firstborn son. And he's 28 now. And he can't walk.
And his brother gone to his brother gets deployed to Iraq in the middle of our film, and he's over there now.
Which I find very interesting, because the family really is a microcosm of America in a way. I mean, the father has a different viewpoint of the war than the mother and Thomas.
Yeah, it's a red and blue family.
Yeah. So as a documentarian, what kind of presence do you have to be in the moment, Ellen, to capture such kind of painful moments of intimacy?
You just have to be present, just like you said, in the moment. So you have to kind of be ready and be there, but most of the time is not spent filming for the real intimate moments. You know, those... Some of those I shot alone, and then we had more public events in the film where, you know, Phil was very involved, and we had other camera people and sound people and lighting, and we have one wonderful scene that Bill Moyers actually opened his show about Body of War with, the scene from the church where Thomas goes to speak, and it just so happens that the New York transit strike hits the day he's supposed to go do the speech. And Phil has taken one vehicle with some of the camera people over to the church, and I'm in the other taxi cab with Thomas.
Right.
And we're stuck in Manhattan, and we can't get to the church on time.
And Ellen is in the right front seat of the taxi.
Right.
And shoots one of the best scenes in our movie. I mean, I'll tell you, the girl spins silk, really, out of everything. It was just one of the best scenes in our movie, and it's so impressive, you know, that she even thought to do this, that maybe this is something we can use, you know. I mean, a lot of camera people would be sitting on the camera around then and complaining about how long it took to get there.
Right. But then again, the structure, it does move between Thomas's story and... The kind of the selling of the war and the process by which the Senate voted for the war. And I'm wondering what inspired that kind of structure.
Well, that was my idea. I had seen the October 2003 Iraq War Resolution. and I was shocked. I couldn't get over it. It was essentially a superficial bumper sticker debate in which several of the members of the House and the Senate took the White House talking points and actually read them verbatim from the floor. A smoking gun can become a mushroom cloud. The fear campaign was underway by the White House. This is 3 weeks before an election. This is October 2002. You will recall the invasion was March of 2003. And what we see is senators literally, it's unbelievable the hysteria that this reached. Ted Stevens of Alaska, in the middle of our film, stands up on the floor of the Senate and says, "History will show that the nations that stopped Saddam Hussein saved the world."
Right.
This is what they were saying. So, you know, it's a study in how we got to this war that caused this young man to lose his ambulatory ability when he was 24 years old. This is a terribly consequential vote, one of the most tragic votes. This is not an overstatement in the history of the Congress. I mean, my goodness, only 133 members of the House. So we weave this throughout our film because, Thomas, without it, it's kind of a, oh, look at this lad, how sad. And Thomas didn't want that kind of film. And neither did I. Neither did Ellen. We wanted to make a statement. And this film speaks for Thomas and his mother, just to name two people, both of whom think that one more death in this war is morally indefensible. And we think that material from the Senate and the House floor is revealing in how shallow it was and how well orchestrated, and it's just the opposite of thoughtful.
Well, it also delivers another very heroic and inspirational figure into the film as well, and that's Senator Robert Byrd. I mean, he's one of 23 senators to vote in opposition of the war.
Right. Robert Byrd, the longest serving member of the United States Senate in history, stands in the middle of our film once again on the Senate floor and pleads with the American people to let this leadership know that you don't want this resolution jammed through this Congress before the election. The life of your son may depend upon it. The life of your daughter may depend upon it. I mean, this is October 2002. This is 4 months before the invasion, for God's sake. And they just dismissed him. He was patronized. He called attention to the fact that this was not a constitutional move, and it wasn't. Giving the president a resolution which says, here if you have to, is not accommodating the mandate of the Constitution. Only Congress can declare war, and Congress hasn't done it since the early 40s because it doesn't want to. It's too dangerous. It's a third rail issue.
And meanwhile, Senator Byrd, I believe he's the most tenured senator in history? Is that
history of the Senate. No one has served more. He passed Strom a couple years ago.
Something like 17,000 votes, and he even said that this is the most
important vote he'd ever cast. Yes, he did say that.
And the meeting between Senator Byrd and Thomas at the end of near the end of the film is just, it's magical. I want to know, who were both of you present for that meeting, and if you could describe that moment for me.
Well, we discussed this a long time. We really had to work real hard to figure out how do we mesh these two elements without confusing everybody. And just, you know, and I had been trying to get into Byrd's office for a long time, really almost a year. And I finally got in, and what I did was show him choruses. That's all I showed him. I showed him choruses from the C-SPAN material. Saddam is training Al Qaeda in bomb making. He's training them to bomb make. He's this, you know, on the Echo, and I showed him some of those. So he had a sense of what we were up to. And the next day we showed up with Thomas Young and filmed it.
Oh, amazing. From a filmmaking standpoint, this is what I'm curious about, because Mr. Donahue, you've been in media for most of your life, and for you to just now enter the film medium, what surprised you about it?
Oh, boy, a lot of things. I was a lamb in the woods in many ways. Ellen was a big help. I mean, really, Ellen, I don't know where. I'd still be wandering around in the woods. It's very complicated. It's very expensive. And there's just a lot of moving parts. You know, and that's why, you know, having Ellen on this was a big break, probably bigger than I've been with a lot of camera people all my life.
Right.
And you can never use everything they shoot, and that was the case with Ellen. I mean, everything she brought back was usable. But beyond that, beyond this technical ability, everything she brought back was really very creative. I mean, she's got a great eye. The girl is something. And so that was a break for me, for Mr. Amateur, you know it all. She survived, you know, being a co-director with me, you know, can you imagine? And here we are, you know, and we, you know, we're just counting on our, because we have been so well received, you know. And by the way, the film's only 87 minutes long, you know, we'll have you to dinner by 9. It's not a rant, it's not a preachment. I'm not in it. We think that'll sell a couple extra tickets. And here you go. I wanted it to be 85 minutes because that's the length of the March of the Penguins. But I missed it by 2. But we have longer credits. So.
Right, right.
Absolutely. It is a fantastic film. And you say it's 87 minutes. Were there a lot of footage left on the, floor that was painful to leave?
Yes, yes.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Always painful to leave it behind. But
I would imagine.
So, everybody wanted it to move along and to be dynamic, and it does do that.
So, Ms. Spear, I'm wondering how, I know it's playing festivals across the country, it has been for quite some time now, and it has some limited theatrical runs, or, if you could tell me how our viewers might be able to find it near them.
We've been in a lot of cities, and we continue to roll out in a lot more cities. I'm not sure when we're going to stop rolling out, maybe when this war comes to an end,
right.
But there's too many cities for me to tell you.
I could mention Chicago next week.
Yes, Chicago next week, St. Louis, and those are the two big ones coming up. But if you go to bodyofwar.com and click on Now Playing, you will see all the cities, festivals it's coming to. We're going to Honolulu if you have listeners there. But we're really going all over the country, and we'll start going elsewhere soon.
And that's fantastic. And also, Body of War, there's a section there of your website, bodyofwar.com. It's a page of things that we can do to make a difference. What kind of things will they find there?
Well, there's 12 things, and they all link you to organizations that have been working for various efforts connected to the war, some working for veterans, some, you know, working explicitly to bring the troops home. But all the issues are covered, and all the organizations like the Iraq Veterans Against the War and Military Families Speak Out are linked. So if you go to the Take Action section of bodyofwar.com, you can see what all those things are.
Okay, great. Do you mind if we take a caller before we close up tonight?
Not at all.
Okay. We have a 623 area code. 623, go ahead.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Tafil, which candidate running for president do you think will affect the war if elected?
Will affect the war how?
If elected, positive or negative.
I see. Well, certainly I will vote for the Democrat, whoever she, he may be. I certainly believe that the next president is just going to have to get out. What's just heartbreaking is that we have to wait for a change in administration for this to happen.
Yeah.
That's, you know, that's a political decision.
Right.
And we have more people coming home dead and grievously injured in this war. For what? I mean, can you imagine those two uniformed officers coming up your front porch today, mothers look out the window and they faint. This is what is happening for this war against a country that had none of this stuff, that didn't attack us on 9/11, repeat, did not have anything to do with 9/11.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Jerry, go ahead.
I have a question from Daniel Moon in the chat room, and he would like to know where the profits from the film are going.
Well, as I announced early on, I will accept no profits from this film. Thomas has already, Ellen talked about his album a little bit ago, and mentioned that, Ellen, the Sire Records deal.
Right.
Yeah, well, Sire Records put out an album that Thomas Young curated, also called Body of War, and they offered Thomas $100,000. And Thomas, being Thomas, didn't take it and said that he wanted all the money to go to the Iraq veterans against the war.
Right.
So, and then profits from our film, should there be any, would go to Thomas.
Okay.
Fantastic. One more caller. I believe this is our DVD correspondent, actually, Aaron. Aaron, is this you? Did you have a question?
I do have a question.
Go right ahead.
Hello. Hello, Mr. Donahue. Mr.
Hi.
Sarah. How are you doing? I have a question, Mr. Donahue, just to broaden kind of this political spectrum just a little, and also to tie in with a little bit, I guess, if you don't mind the word, your legacy, in that, you know, yes, this is your first film, but obviously ever since, you know, beginning of the show, you've been dealing with political issues. My father was an air traffic controller up till 81, and I remember him telling me stories when you had the controllers on your show back in that, around that time during the strike, and you were one of the few outlets who were actually supporting the strike, which was a big deal. And I'm curious of, because I'm all about film preservation and preservation of history, I'm curious if you've had any thought of doing something similar to what Charlie Rose has done, of putting your shows online. And that,
well, thank you for that suggestion. I remember the Patco story very well.
And it's still relevant to this day, even with American Airlines. People may not think, you know, people may not even remember the air traffic controller strike, but this recent American Airlines fiasco is totally tied in to, can be traced back all the way to the Patco thing.
You mean the maintenance fiasco?
Yeah, all this maintenance. I mean, this was stuff that the unions were telling people
right.
a long time ago.
What I remember about Patco was the arrogance and the dismissing behavior of Reagan. Reagan came down from on high and put his jackboot right on the neck of Patco, and he really isolated them, you know. And I thought it was a sneak attack, and labor was on its back anyway. And, you know, I never crossed a picket line myself. If you think I'm bragging, I am. So I remember those days very much. I'm not sure your question was.
His question was about concerning your personal legacy of shows.
Universal owns the library, and I will have conversations with them sometime soon about what we might do with this. For example, I don't think our library is digitalized, or is
right.
it digitized? You know, that's just the first step that has to be done. So we'll see. It's very expensive, and we have probably 3,000 shows out there.
It's an incredible body of work you have. We're going to take one more call, and then we're going to close out. You guys have been so generous to us. We have a 702 area code. Go right ahead.
Actually, I'm going to go ahead. I think the room has said that they wanted to get this Daniel character on with him, so I believe I'm going to go ahead and let him have the last question there, Jamie.
Okay, Mark,
okay.
Go ahead. Is he on your line?
He's not on the line. He should be on you guys' line, but not on my line.
Okay, well, that's fine. I don't want to spend any more of our guest time, but thank you so much. Mr. Donahue and Ms. Spiro, I admire your work so much, and I appreciate you being on with us so much tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're pleased to be here, and we'd like to say that we do have a website, bodyofwar.com, and we open Chicago next Wednesday.
Absolutely, and please go see this movie. It's every American should see this movie. It's a fantastic, engaging, inspiring film, and thank you so much for making it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, good night, both of you. Thank you so much.
Good night.
Good night.
That was our interview with Phil Donahue. Man, the chat room.
I'm sorry, I can't keep a straight face.
The chat room is alive and smoking tonight. It's great to see so many people and there are so many great friends.
Yeah, it is.
Our Donahue interview, I thought it went really well. I felt good about it after the fact. I was a little uncertain until I went back and replayed it, and it was a very dynamic interview. It helped in no small part by Mr. Donahue's
right.
enthusiasm and passion. I mean, once
Absolutely.
That guy gets going, Something I revealed in the chat room, but those live listeners out there that aren't in the chat room, it's interesting, the day after the broadcast aired, the publicist got back to me and said, Mr. Donahue wants a copy of your intro that you wrote for him because he likes some of the things you said in there. I said, does he want to use it for, like, promotional stuff or something? And he said, I'm not sure. So I sent him that, mm-hmm. and I don't know what became of that. But if you go on their website, bodyofwar.com, it'll tell you all the dates that the movie's playing. It's playing, you know, year-round. I think mm-hmm. they just signed a video deal. Yeah, so it'll be on home video soon, and I'm sure it'll air on cable channels. But it's still playing film festivals. But if you go to their media section, there's two interviews, and they've been everywhere. They've been on Meet the Press. They've been on hundreds of interviews and newspapers and what have you. There's two interviews listed, one for Bill Moyer and one for Movie Geeks United.
Well, we couldn't be in better company.
I tell you what, man. I saw that. I was like, we're making it slowly but surely.
No, it's great. You couldn't, I mean, really, you know, Bill Moyer's, that's pretty incredible.
Our devilish plan is coming to fruition.
Yes, it is. World domination.
We thank everyone out there for listening tonight to this special replay show of the Best of Movie Geeks United, Volume 1, Brian De Palma and Phil Donahue. And we'll put together another Best of Movie Geeks show and probably air it towards the end of the month. But this Sunday, like I said, Jonathan Levine, the director of The Whackness, we also have the director behind a heartbreaking documentary called Dear Zachary, and that's all this Sunday. And some exciting prospects for the weeks upcoming in July. So stay close to your bulletin boards and blogs, and we'll tell you all about it.
All right.
Guys, thanks so much for being with us tonight. Jerry, yeah. Thank you as usual, man.
No, thank you, and thanks to everyone in the chat room for making a very enjoyable time.
Absolutely, man.
I got a feeling this thing's going to be going on all night.
Yeah, I'll stick in here a while.
Okay.
Here's the closing theme. See you guys Sunday night.
Take care.
Are you a filmmaker looking for a great score for your next movie? Well, look no further than Michael McCormick, the composer whose works you hear at the opening and the closing of every episode of Movie Geeks United. This is a phenomenal talent, and you can hear more samples of his work at michaelmccormickmusic.com or on his MySpace page, which you can access through the Movie Geeks United Top Friends.